We're now going to introduce you all, though many of you may know him already, is Kevin Sherd, who is author of his latest book is called Uprising in the City, Made in America. He's co-founder of the Do Right Foundation, and his previous book was his memoir, Lessons of Redemption. Kevin, right. Good to have you on the show. Welcome.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm very well, man. How are you
doing?
Okay,
I'm doing great.
So let's take a step backwards for folks who don't know who Kevin Sherd is yet.
Okay.
All right. I mean, your first book was Lessons of Redemption. I mean, you are a man who grew up in here in the city.
Yes.
Spent your time in prison.
Almost 12 years.
12 years, right?
Yeah.
So talk a bit about your legacy from your first book for a second, just people get a feel for who you are.
So the first book is about me growing up here in Baltimore, young kid. I got involved in the drug trade in West Baltimore at age 16, and that led me into the streets. I was involved in the heroin business for several years. And I went to prison, but in prison I started going to college. I started taking college courses in prison. And I found that education was the thing that really changed my life, right? It really helped me turn the corner. I know we always talk about change life and cliche, but education really helped me see the world in a different way.
Right? What year was that, by the way, you're talking about?
I got back to Baltimore in 2006.
Okay.
Yeah, so you're roughly 10 years ago. Yeah.
I mean, because a lot of that stuff inside of prisons has been taken away. It's harder and harder for men and women inside of jail to, you know, in the 70s, you could get Pell Grants and people got their AA degrees while in jail and actually go on campus.
Right.
But that.
So for us, federal prison, that was a little bit of a misconception.
Oh, this was in the federal joint.
Yeah,
right.
So they took away the Pell Grant, right? But you still were able to pay for your own credits out of your pocket at a discounted rate. So I paid for my own credits because I knew the value of that education. Look, I knew that when I got back to the streets, I needed something other than the street corner to be able to live, survive, and actually take care of my daughter. So, you know, the onus was on me to do something different. So I paid for the courses, I took the college classes, and it was enlightening. But even when I was released, I started working with ex-offenders to help them find jobs in West Baltimore, and even helping these guys understand that you have skills, you bring something to the table. You just have to understand what that is you bring to the table. So even a guy that's out in the street, well, he might be great at sales, he might be great at marketing, he might be great at management, he may be even great at leadership. How do you take those skills, put them in the corporate world or our world, and prosper and be able to make a living off of that?
So talk about this new project
before
we go back and get into the book. What's this new project about?
So Uprising in the City really is about my perception of what took place in April of 2015. At that time, I think nobody really knew where that situation was going. Mm-hmm. Right? People were nervous. People were anxious. This had never happened in Baltimore before, right?
Well, 1968 happened in Baltimore.
Well, let me take that back. In my lifetime.
Okay, right.
It had never happened before in my lifetime.
Right. That's a significant difference because in my lifetime, I lived through 68.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm going to get back to 68 in a second.
Right.
So I'd never personally witnessed anything like this before, right? So I didn't know where this was going. So in this book, I just talked about, you know, my perception of that situation. But I also did some research because I wanted to look in deeper. Because this was deeper than some kids that just mowed down and throwing some rocks. This was just deeper than, you know, the whole Freddie Gray matter, right? This was something that had been brewing for a long time here in Baltimore. But why had it been brewing, right? And why did the people feel the way they felt? Because I remember out on North in Pennsylvania Avenue, just looking at the protesters and looking at the anger in people's eyes, right? And I knew this stuff wasn't manufactured. Like, this wasn't stuff you could just make up, right? There was a deep feeling of something, and I wanted to understand what that something was and be able to relay that to the people. But then at the same time, even watching, I spent a lot of time watching CNN, watching the news, and there were things about Baltimore that were uncovered that I had no idea. Living in the city my entire life.
Things like what?
The poverty situation, right?
You mean you understood it. You're saying it was uncovered for other people, is what you're saying.
So I understood Of course, you drive around the city, you know friends that struggle years, but the depth of the poverty,
yes, right?
Right. In comparison right. to other cities across the country, right? 1968, right? So I'd heard people in Baltimore talk about 1968, the 1968 riots, but I never knew the depth of that situation. I knew it was around Martin Luther King, but I didn't know the scope of it, right? So, I mean, Baltimore's burned significantly in 1968, right? 6 people were killed, 100 people were injured, right?
Thousands arrested.
And thousands.
The avenue was destroyed.
Was it destroyed, right?
And never rebuilt.
So even now, there's still places in Baltimore that still haven't been rebuilt since 1968. So it was a lot of things that I just didn't know that this event kind of made me want to go out and find out, right? But also, how do you explain the people's pain to the world? Because the world was looking at Baltimore in a totally different light. March of 2015, I was actually at a speaking engagement at Lemoyne Owen College in Memphis, Tennessee. And while I was in Memphis, Tennessee, this was my first time there. Mm-hmm. Ironically, I got a chance to take a visit to the hotel, the Lorraine Motel, where Martin Luther King was assassinated, right? And just being there for the first time and reading about this event in history for so many years, actually being close to the balcony where he was assassinated, right? And just kind of, you know, just going back in your mind about what that day was like, right? It was just eye-opening to me. And then to just come back to Baltimore in that April of 2015, and learning about these similarities to 1968, right? Not just the scale of the burning, but also the emotion of the people. So in 1968, people were upset about poverty, unemployment, disenfranchisement, racial segregation, racial injustice, right? Fast forward 50 years later, we're having the same protest about unemployment, poverty, disenfranchisement, and social injustice 50 years later. So in chapter 3, 1968, I kind of talk about that, and I talk about the some of the similarities to that subject.
But there's a dislocation now, I think, that you can see that for the generation, today's generation, that was different than the generations in 1968. Because we were in a very different political moment. Because people in the poorest neighborhoods in Baltimore live in isolation from the rest of the world. You know, your little square block area, and that's all you see.
That's all you see.
Right?
That's all you
see. So we're in a very, and our education system, even though it was semi-segregated back then, it's mm-hmm. resegregated now in many ways. And it's and so the kids are faced with kind of things that they, in some ways, even harder than kids faced in 68.
You know, it's a lot deeper. You know, I explained to you earlier, I started dealing drugs at age 16 in West Baltimore, right? And during that time, I'm looking back, you know, 20, 22 years old. We didn't think about the future back then. We didn't think we'd be alive long enough to see the future. So we didn't have hope, right? We didn't think about, you know, a retirement account or a 401k or, you know, what would life be like at 50 or 60 years old. At that time, in the streets, involved in that business, because we didn't think we'd be alive long enough because everybody else around us are dying. Right. So everybody, guys are getting shot. Guys are going off to prison for 30 and 40, 50 years. Right. So you don't feel like I'm planning for my future. You don't even realize you have a future. Right. So when we talk about poverty, there are people, many people in this city that live in poverty every day. They don't think about the future because they don't even think they'll have a future. Right. They don't think about tomorrow. There may not be a tomorrow. I'm only living for today and maybe tomorrow or the next day, but not 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road. These are things that normal Americans think about. retirement. What am I going to do in my life when I'm 60 years old, 70 years old? Social Security, right? So you talk about hope for the future. A lot of people living in poverty in Baltimore don't even feel like they will have a future. And poverty plays a huge role on, you know, people's everyday lives, but also people's decision making for the rest of their life.
So what is in the latter part of your book here? Talk a bit about, what came to you in this kind of writing this book, because you're searching for solutions and you have this foundation. Talk a bit about that work.
So we talk about solutions. We're talking about Port Covington. Let's just use that as one example, right?
All right.
We're talking about solutions. And the unemployment rate in Baltimore amongst African Americans is one of the highest in the country, right? How do we make sure that people have jobs so that they can feel good about themselves and they can feel good about the future, about family, about growth, right? The education system, revamping our education system to make sure that young people have the tools that they need so they can be successful throughout life. So there are models all across the country of successful education systems that work, right, in urban areas, pushing Baltimore's leadership to use some of these systems, pushing Baltimore's leadership to really focus on unemployment, to make sure that people have jobs and feel like they, you know, they have a future. I one of the things I talked about in this book, I've been working on this project. It's the Educate One Foundation, and it's also it's about providing resources and financial support for inner city young people that want to go to college, right? They have the grades, they have the test mm-hmm. scores, right? But even when you get a grant or even when you get a scholarship, there's also that gap money that sometimes is missing for college students, right? And I learned about this traveling around the country, speaking at a lot of the HBCUs, right? Kids from African-American kids from inner cities that don't have that family support. So they may have a scholarship. They may have even some grants, right? But they might not have that ability to call home and say, "Ma, I need an extra $300 because, you know, this just happened. The car just broke down. I need an extra a new pair of sneakers or whatever," right? But important stuff, right? But so I wanted to focus on supporting college students because there are so many kids in Baltimore that have what it takes to be successful, right? They just need a little push, right? And these are kids growing up in poverty, growing up in tough situations, growing up with alcohol-addicted parents, heroin-addicted parents, but they also have the tools and the motivation. So how do we just give them a little bit of push? So you talked about solutions. One of the things that I'm working on is building this foundation where we can provide financial support for inner-city students to have the grades, but they just need a little push to get them through that first year of college, because the first year is the most trying year, and you know that yourself, of college. If you can get through that first year, you have a better chance of making it the rest of the way.
Kevin Sherrod, author of Uprising in the City, Made in America, co-founder and president of the Do Right Foundation. His previous book was memoir. His memoir was Lessons of Redemption, which was an amazing book. And Kevin, thanks for dropping by the
thanks
studio.
Thanks a lot.
Good to
have
you here.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Mark Gunnery. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our research producer is Calvin Perry. Our production assistant is Nadia Ramlagan. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Now send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. The podcast of Mark Steiner Show, and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Have a wonderful weekend. Talk to y'all on Monday. Take care.